At a time when investors are confronted with market volatility and a variety of challenges fueled by the uncertainty of inflation, unsettled geopolitical tensions, and economic pressures, Justin Klein and Steve Peasley stand ready to take your finance and investment questions and share their unbiased answers. This is InvestTalk, independent thinking, shared success. InvestTalk is made possible by KPP Financial, a registered investment advisor firm serving clients throughout the United States. The clarity for your path forward starts now. Here is KPP Chief Executive Officer, Financial Advisor, Justin Klein.
Good afternoon, fellow investors, and welcome back to InvestTalk. This is our Monday, March 11th, 2024 edition. I'm Justin Klein, and our goal here, as always, is to help you become a better investor. And joining me in that pursuit for today, once again, is Luke Guerrero. Thanks for being back here, Luke.
Thanks for having me, and I hope everybody out there is dealing with daylight savings time better than I am.
Now, to accomplish this, I have a mix of educational and actual material to touch on today. And, of course, most importantly is your questions. That's what drives this show. But first, before we get to all of that, I want to remind you that we're doing a new contest, the inaugural InvestTalk Market Madness. And we are here ready to help you win, hopefully. This is basically a twist on the current or the upcoming March Madness competition where it pits basketball teams against each other. Well, instead, we're pitting companies against each other on one particular day. And we have different days with different matchups. We're going to preview them. And the best bracket wins $1,000. So if you are ready to join the fray, all you have to do is head over to investtalk.com, print out your bracket, fill it out, and use the link provided to complete your bracket. The last day to do it is March 17th. Okay. And be sure to download every podcast going forward for updates and details on the InvestTalk Market Madness contest. Now, with that said, we're going to talk about the market performance today and run down some show topics, but right after we answer our first caller question now.
Hello, InvestTalk. This is Mike from Texas. Just had a question about Tyson Foods, ticker TSN. Curious on what you thought of the company overall and just kind of as a long-term hold. Look forward to hearing your answer on the podcast. Appreciate everything you guys do.
All right. Looking at Tyson Foods, TSN is the symbol. And for everyone else out there, they produce beef, chicken, pork, and related products for grocery stores. Probably one of the largest food producers out there. This is definitely down on its luck over the past couple of years. It peaked out around $100 per share. Now we're down at $55.73. But Luke, it is well off its lows, around $45. Now we're at $55 and change. And the technicals are certainly improving, and it looks like the earnings are snapping back. They made it $8.73 in 2022, but last year only $1.34. This year is supposed to be $2.25 and $3.55 next year. Are we getting back to a more normal earnings picture for Tyson?
Very well could be. I certainly think they would hope so as well. But I know that for Tyson specifically, and maybe we answered this question a couple weeks ago, and that's why I recall it so much. But you know, the demand side of Tyson's product certainly hasn't fallen off, right? People are buying chicken more and more than they have at any other time. And so it was a surprise to me, given that dynamic that Tyson has had such a rough time, which led me to believe that maybe some of it was due to an overextension. They're about $10 billion on debt relative to their $18 billion market cap. There's a little bit of short interest out there. Their dividend yield looks okay. But like you said, there's some varying levels of profitability that are concerning or should be concerning to anyone who's looking to invest there in 2023. I see that they lost money. And in 2024 and 2025, they're projected to make some money again. So certainly, like you said, the technicals are improving, which is good. I think it's relative to its book value, it's at a fair price. It's trading about one, which is well below its 50% below its 5-year average of 1.5. So if you're going to pick it up, certainly hoping that their profitability continues to improve, now looks like a reasonable price for it.
Yeah, I agree. The technicals are improving. It's just a matter of will their business come back to historic profitability? And if it does, this is certainly on the cheaper side. You know, pre-pandemic, they were earning over $5 per share. And then during the pandemic, they did very, very well, earning over $8 per share. But obviously, those dynamics shifted. And now we're kind of getting back to that mean around a 10-year mean, right around $5, $6 per share. So if you head back towards that level, trading at 55 and change, that's pretty cheap, 3.5% dividend yield. And their debt will be certainly serviceable if you get back to those profitability levels. So I think it's a reasonable risk at this time. So I'd give Tyson a tentative thumbs up, but certainly you need to be on watch. Could potentially dip back down if the progress isn't continued. All right, now we have a lot of ground to cover over the next 45 minutes or so. Our main focus point concerns this story. Competition is heating up for the big retailers in the grocery game, and as retailers compete for grocery shoppers, some of the big names in the business have zeroed in on the same strategy, which is getting deliveries to customer doors. So we're going to talk about their grocery delivery system and the retail sector more broadly. Now, we also have some other topics on the docket as well. One is in regards to the banks and new banking regulations that are coming down the pipe and how that's going to impact the industry. Also, the Panama Canal, the Straits of Hormuz, and the Red Sea, those are all areas where there are shipping problems. So we're going to dig into the details there and see what kind of impacts that's having on the broader shipping market and the cost there. And then also China is kind of turning a bit on Tesla, Apple, and we're going to look at some trends there as well. We also have some voice bank questions in regards to Clearway Energy and how to calculate a company's debt levels. Okay. And of course, most importantly, your finance and investment questions are always number one. So if you call and ask your question live, we will answer it first. So that's the best way to get a hold of us. And we're going into a quick break, but on the other side, we'll talk about today's market activity. But remember, like I said, if you're listening via our live stream or on AM 1220 radio in the Silicon Valley area, you can call right now at 888-99-CHART.
InvestTalk callers make each podcast unique.
I was calling about Intel, if it's worth holding on to, or should I sell it?
Their questions are curious.
Hello, I have saved up around $80,000, and I was wondering what I should do to make it grow.
Careful.
Oh, I'm just wondering, is this a value trap? Because it looks like it's gone down quite a bit.
Concerned.
It's taken quite the tumble today. I've been trying to get out of this position for a while. I think I waited too long.
And clever.
It does seem to be situated in some areas of expanding population.
And Justin Klein, Steve Peasley, and now Luke Guerrero are always ready with their unbiased answers.
And this is, it looks like a classic example of chasing yield. Don't chase the yield.
Next 12 months price to earnings is around 30. I just don't see it at this price.
Don't forget to call InvestTalk, 888-99-CHART. In today's market, more than ever, you need unbiased investing guidance because it can help you achieve financial freedom. Well, you've come to the right place. InvestTalk, 888-99-CHART.
Now let's take a look at the market today, Luke. It was a decidedly down day overall, but kind of depends on where you were looking. The growth side of the market once again had a follow through from Friday's major sell-off, last Tuesday's major sell-off as well. So you did get a bit of a follow through. I wouldn't say it was a dramatic one. You had gold up as well, but you're certainly seeing some weakness out of those mega cap tech names. NVIDIA was down 2%. Apple was up a little bit. Palantir down about 2.5%. So what did you see in the markets today besides that weakness?
Yeah, well, the S&P 500 was down 11 basis points. Russell 2000 U.S. small caps down roughly 80 basis points. So small caps did underperform today. I think, like you mentioned, the general tone I saw was that follow through, that although you see some of these large cap tech names underperforming now, the S&P Equal Weight Index was up 13 basis points. So it reached an all-time high for the first time in 2 years last week. So still, even though some of these names that we're used to hearing having long-standing rallies falling today, you still see a general broadening of that rally overall. So I think all eyes are mostly going to be on CPI tomorrow as we wait to see if the general themes that have driven this rally are still intact. But other than that, really not much going on today.
Yeah, I agree. Everyone's kind of waiting for the CPI number tomorrow, even though the PCE number is what the Fed follows most of all. I think it was just mainly a rotation day with the value side of the market. Large cap value, according to Morningstar, was up 43 basis points. Large cap growth was down 53 basis points. So you're talking nearly a full 1% difference between those two. Same with mid caps, up 45 basis points on the value side, down 49 basis points on the growth side. And the worst category, small cap growth, down 0.68%, 68 basis points there. So you continue rotation. And as I've said over the past few weeks now, you're starting to see that momentum slow in the growth side of the market. And you know, I think it's, I don't say a matter of time, but it's certainly an underlying trend change shift that you started to see in the fall. You had a bit of reversal to start the year, but that's still rolling over as we go into, you know, the second quarter. It's not far away, just a few weeks away. I know we had daylight savings time over the weekend. We have the first day of spring coming up. What's that, next week? So this is the time of year. A lot of things do tend to shift, and that's what you're seeing in the markets, a lot of trend changing and shifting. Now let's keep things moving and pivot back to the InvestTalk Voice Bank for a question that came in earlier on 888-99 chart.
My name is Dan. My question was how you guys determine when you say that a company has a lot of debt or doesn't have much debt, how do you determine that? Thank you.
Well, the amount of debt is going to be in relation to the cash flow of the business, the earnings of the business. So it's all relative what a lot is and what a little is. You know, we have a lot of data tools, FactSet, et cetera, that we can look at the numbers in aggregate and total, but also we can even dig down to what debt they have with different banks, right, with the revolving credit line, as well as the bonds they have outstanding, et cetera. So it depends on what, you know, there's a lot of ways that we can see that. Now, you as the novice investor, you're not really going to have access to that data. But Luke, they can certainly download the reports, their earnings reports and their balance sheet and do the analysis themselves, right?
They can, yeah. And it's also important to note that it's not just what debt they have, but the maturity level of that debt, when it's going to mature, rather. So, you know, two companies, one having $60 billion due, all else equal, 5 years from now, and the other one's push it out 30 years, those debt levels are not the same because one of them's going to have to roll it for likely higher interest rates. There's a lot going on there. So taking a look at total debt is important. One thing that we look at that we mention frequently is interest rate coverage ratio. So taking a look at how your actual profits are able to pay off your debt, how leveraged are you, is important. But I think the main lesson here is it certainly is all relative because there's more factors that go into it than just one number.
Yeah, exactly. And a lot of times you might see long-term debt. That's debt that's a 1 year out or further. And then you might have your current, we'll call current debt. And that is anything that's due within the next year. So, but long-term could mean, as Luke said, could mean 18 months it matures or 18 years. It just depends on the company and how long they've termed out their debt. And that's one thing that's happening right now. Just a side note here is everyone's talking about higher interest rates and how that's going to impact the economy and these companies. Well, a lot of, especially the bigger companies, they've termed out their debt during at the bottom. When I say term out, meaning they're issuing debts that's going out 10, 15, 20 years, especially because they were smart. They were getting, Apple was getting, being able to borrow at 2% plus for a time. So they were smart to do that over a very extended period of time. So it's very important not just to look at the total amount of debt, but as Luke said, the duration that debt typically has on average. Thanks for the call. Now we're moving into a break, and our focus point is next. And the phone lines are open, waiting for you right now at 888-99-CHART.
Everybody wants a secure financial future. That means you'll have finance and investment questions. InvestTalk, 888-99-CHART.
Now, our main focus point today, Luke, is about the competition that is heating up for big retailers in the grocery game. And we know that the retail industry in general is pretty competitive. And this is actually a topic that literally hits close to home, because my closest grocery store to my house, very close, probably two lights away, maybe half a mile, just closed about a week ago. And
oh, really?
Yeah, it's a Gelson's, so it's a kind of a local one here in Southern California, but it just kind of shows you how part of a business the grocery industry really is. And that's why there's a lot of competition heating up, especially for delivery. And I'll have to say, I'm probably one of the problems. You know, I consistently get my groceries delivered from Whole Foods, and I go on the app. They know what I've ordered before. I can easily browse. And it's delivered to my door within just a few hours. So other retailers are doing this. Target just announced a new paid membership program with free same-day home delivery. Walmart has a similar program. And Kroger, they just announced earnings with online sales up 24% year over year and overall sales up 10% year over year. So, and that's pushed the stock, you know, to new 52-week highs. So it's pretty clear everyone's pushing into the grocery delivery business. And the question is that the future? I know Kroger has launched these distribution facilities in areas that they don't even have physical stores, but they're still delivering products to customers because they have the distribution there. Not necessarily the end stores. So it's a pretty interesting shift that's happening within this industry. And the question is, who is best prepared to be the winner here? What do you think, Luke?
Yeah, well, I think it's an interesting dynamic shift, especially it's been, 7 years since Amazon made that strategic acquisition of Whole Foods, which certainly has
been that long.
I know. It's been 7 years. I know my girlfriend likes to use Amazon Fresh as well. It's convenient. It's about meeting consumers where they are.
Yeah.
And where consumers are.
In their homes, on their phones.
Is home. It's in their homes, on their phones. And that's truer now than it ever has been in a post-pandemic world.
Yeah.
I think I never, before the pandemic, would have thought of getting my groceries delivered. I don't do that anymore. As you know, I only shop at Costco. Love Costco. And, you know, I think that these companies that are shifting how they're reaching their customers, one that strikes me is Walmart, because not only does Walmart offer the same day delivery and the locations of Walmart make it easier for them to do it to a lot of regions, but they also, I don't know if you knew this, are offering free memberships along with certain credit cards, premium credit cards. So now they're trying to break into this consumer market by including it as a service along with the with someone's annual credit card fee.
Amazon does the same thing, right? With I have the Amazon credit card that I believe includes Amazon Prime, but it also gives me 5% back on purchases from Amazon as well Whole Foods.
So the Amazon credit card, I don't believe that actually pays for the Prime itself, because I have that as well, and I still got charged for Prime. But what I mean is that the Amex Platinum will reimburse you for your Walmart Plus subscription.
Oh, I have Amazon.
And so that's Amex something Platinum. That is completely, that's something completely separate from Walmart, right? And so that's how they're trying to take over what has been really held singularly by Amazon. And the fact that they're doing that, going outside of the company, making these deals with external credit card companies and rewards services, shows how important they believe it is to win this market.
And it's increasingly becoming more competitive, and the FTC is not allowing the consolidation, right? Kroger tried to buy Albertsons and they blocked that. Now they're going to sue to try to get that to go through, but it's pretty clear that that's consolidation to gain scale, gain distribution is going to be very difficult. And so the players that already have that built-in scale, that built-in distribution network, I think are going to be the winners. And the question is, how can you actually, like you said, meet them where they are, but also where their tastes are? So one of the reasons why I use Whole Foods is because their product offering is, you know, it's pretty healthy. You know, it's probably not as good as it used to be before Amazon bought them, but it's still better than, say, a Kroger's, for example. So I think it'll be interesting to see is also, can they shift to more local produce, for example, right? Sprouts has done very well catering to the very health conscious consumer and be able to grow in that way. So I like that secular shift. So I think it's going to be the winners are going to be those that the Targets, the Walmarts, the Costco's, the Kroger's that already have that scale that can also meet the tastes as well. Because I think that will continue to shift, that people want fresher produce, better produce, and those trends will continue. So very interesting to see how this is evolving and who the winners will be. But if you're trying to invest in this space, you have to be very aware of these trends. Now we're heading to a break, so give us a call now at 888-99-CHART.
Let's say you've been thinking about learning a new language. Okay, why? I mean, how would it come in handy? And where would you want to use it? Could it be that you have an upcoming international trip? Or maybe you want to connect with family members or friends from a different culture? I think you should know about Rosetta Stone. With millions of users, it's been the world's most trusted language learning program for 30 years. Rosetta Stone is available on your desktop or as an app with audio companion and the ability to download lessons offline. Rosetta Stone truly immerses you in the language you want to learn. It has a built-in, patented speech recognition engine called True Accent. So as you practice speaking, you'll get feedback on how well you pronounce words. With Rosetta Stone, you pick up a language naturally, first with words, then phrases, then sentences. It's an intuitive process designed for long-term retention. You really learn to speak, listen, and think in your new language. Rosetta Stone is an amazing value, so your special skill set is within easy reach. You know you want to do this, so don't put off learning that language. There's no better time than right now to get started. For a very limited time, InvestTalk listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. Visit rosettastone.com/today. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off now at rosettastone.com/today.
This is InvestTalk. Is your portfolio balanced? Is it optimized?
Is it delivering the types of gains you want and need to achieve financial freedom? Well, turn up the volume, because there are many questions that deserve unbiased answers. And Justin Klein is here now, ready to take your calls live. 888-99-CHART.
On the next Invest Talk, we'll look into this question. Is there really a historic level of cash on the stock market's sidelines? But for now, we have a live call. We're going to talk to Sammy in San Francisco, who wants to look at Dash, DoorDash.
Hi, Justin. Thanks for taking my call. I wanted to get your thoughts on DoorDash. Do you think it's a good point to get in? What should I wait?
After it's rallied from 70 to 130, probably not. this is quite the run. It's still well below its 2021 highs when it was at, $260 per share. Now, the positive here is that the company looks to be headed towards profitability. This is supposed to be the first quarter of major profitability for DoorDash. And I will say I'm impressed by the shift in their business and the ability to become cash flow positive, et cetera. However, big however, their fundamentals from a valuation perspective are on the extreme side, would you say, Luke?
Well, they're certainly on the extreme side if you look at price to earnings. But if you look at price to book value, it's only valued at 7.8, which is still pretty high. But, you know, its price to cash flow is 31. I think you said it. They're certainly on the right track to getting profitable. They've never made money before, and their cash flow is increasing, and their profitability has been consistently getting better. But one other thing we have to mention, regardless of it rallying from 70 to 120 in the past 5 months, is it also is in a subsector that is going to be susceptible to regulatory risk, right? That's one of the hot button issues, especially given the past year for organized labor, what they've had. I think trying to bring that to the gig economy is probably their next step. So that's also a risk you have to consider if you're going to invest in DoorDash. I don't know. You've heard me say this again and again. I don't like businesses that don't make money, especially in a time where interest rates are non-zero. But they are headed in the right direction.
Yeah. What I would like to see is a few things. First, not having their share count just continually trend higher. When they went public, they had 317 million shares outstanding. Now they have 404 million shares outstanding. So that's a pretty, and remember, this was in late 2020 when they went public. So you're talking little over 3 years, about 30% increase, about 25% increase in their shares outstanding. I don't like that. And that is not calculated in their cash flows because it's non-stock-based compensation, or it's stock-based compensation, excuse me. So that's one issue. If you look at profitability, not just total profits, but return on equity, et cetera, it's improving, but it's still in the negative 8% range. I don't like that. So I would wait for a large pullback. I think if it gets back below 100 and it's still heading towards profitability next year, right? It's still going to earn $4 per share if analysts are maintaining that number. I think that's a reasonable number to pay, $100 based on $4 future earnings with this type of growth. But I would be very patient. It's also looks like it's peaking out from a technical perspective. It was down $3 today whereas the value side of the market was up. So if growth starts to become out of favor, looks like it's starting to, this will certainly take a hit as well. So something to keep on your watch list, but I would not fire on it quite yet. Thanks for the call. Now let's touch a bit on new banking rules, Luke. And this is in regards to what is called the Basel III. Is it Basel? No, I always say Basel. It's Basel.
Basel.
Let me say that correctly. Basel III endgame. And this is new banking reforms that were outlined over a decade ago, really post financial crisis. And everyone's going to think that new regulation that should be in focusing on the banking crisis of last spring. But the reality is it doesn't really address that. because the financial crisis was a credit crisis. And the banking crisis last year was a duration crisis, or simple terms, right? But this is going to still impact the way that regulators look at banks. They're probably going to have to raise capital. And, you know, there probably still needs to be updated guidelines on the outsized role that large depositors have. That's what happened at Silicon Valley Bank, right? Their 10 largest depositors made up 8% of their total assets, total deposits. So it was easy for that to leave pretty fast. So I'm not sure that these rules are addressing the current problems, because the current problems are not credit related. They are interest rate related. What are your thoughts?
I tend to agree. I think that the regional banking collapse, those that did collapse, was a very specific problem. In 2008, you had widespread systematic use of bad debt as collateral that proliferated and infected the system. It's an easy problem to address because it's easy to identify, and it affected nearly everybody. In this situation, the problem was more than just trying to search for yield by going further out on the yield curve, right? They invested in very safe assets. A lot of it was U.S. Treasuries, right? So from a credit risk perspective, it certainly didn't exist. From a duration risk, it did. That was the problem. But then the other issue was just the diversity of deposit base, especially in Silicon Valley Bank, right? When you have text threads of VCs and startups that are all saying, get your money out now, the speed of information is really what caused the quote-unquote run on that bank. And so when you have a very specific event happen like that, I'm not necessarily sure that you can do much to mitigate that specific event from happening again. I don't know if capital requirements is the answer, because again, they weren't taking on a lot of risk, right?
Yeah.
This is a concentrated deposit base in a concentrated asset at a time when interest rates are rising. Those are a lot of things that don't tend to happen in tandem over and over.
Yeah. And another alphabet soup of policies that the Fed has implemented, the solution last spring was the BTFP program, right? The Bank Term Funding Program, if I remember correctly. Now that expired today. And what the Fed is trying to do is they are trying to say, instead of using that, which is now gone, is to, if you have a problem, go to the Fed's discount window, which is what is designed for. And the issue, though, is the stigma of a bank going to the Fed's window, because the market is going to know that. And they're probably going to short the stock. Maybe they have a run in the bank, et cetera. And so, you know, is that a good solution? I mean, I don't know how you get rid of the stigma around going to the Fed hat in hand and asking for capital. Because as you said, Luke, the speed of information, the speed of the ability for people to get money out of the bank, it just moves too fast. And I don't think banks are going to want to do that. They're going to look elsewhere. But the Fed obviously wants them to do that instead of selling off assets at a loss and solidifying a balance sheet that is risky, right? When those banks go to the Fed window, it can be short term, and it allows the actual assets on their balance sheet to heal over time and not be forced to sell them at the wrong time. So I don't know. I don't know how they handle this, because I don't see the Fed discount window as a real solution. Do you?
No, I don't. And it also, over a longer period of time, is a signal, right? If anything, the amount of money that is being used in that discount window by specific banks, similar to in 2008 when there was a bunch of TARP money and they forced everyone to take it because they didn't want to signal to the market which banks were susceptible, right?
Yeah.
You have a similar situation here. If you're going to the Fed all the time saying, I need this cash because X amount of deposits are leaving and I don't want to sell all these things for a loss, they're safe, but they're long duration, that's a signal to the market too. And that definitely affects the long-term ability of some of these banks to be able to capitalize themselves and run. So I don't think this is necessarily the answer, but I don't really, I'm not fully of the belief that there is a systemic problem that needed to be solved a year ago. Interest rates aren't going to be zero again and then be for 10 years and then be raised the immediate future. That's just not going to happen, you know, in within the next 20 years. It just doesn't seem likely that you have the catalysts for what caused this occur again.
Yeah, it was somewhat of an anomaly. Now, the bigger question is a year enough time for these banks to kind of get their act in order to, you know, sell off certain assets and reposition their portfolios? Well, we shall see pretty soon, right?
We shall see.
That BTFP did expire. So now let's head over to a caller question, and it's a live one. Jacob in Northern California looking at Qualcomm.
Yeah, so I own Qualcomm. It's grown to about 9 or 10% of my portfolio. I'm thinking about trimming or getting out of it. I just think it's kind of run up with the AI and chip manufacturers, and just wanted to see what you guys think.
Well, I wouldn't sell it simply because of that. In fact, you know, Qualcomm isn't really in the eye of the AI revolution. So I don't think it's up because of that. I think it's up because their business is improving. You know, last quarter, for the first time in over a year, revenues were up 5%. Earnings are up 16%. Earnings next year are supposed to be up another 15%. And they have a dominant IP position within the cellular phone business, cellular phone chip business. And so I think it's a good business. However, 8 to 9% of your portfolio is probably a bit high. And I would say I would use this opportunity to trim probably back to 5% or lower of your overall portfolio. So I wouldn't get rid of it entirely, but certainly this is a good point to trim in my mind.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks for the call. Now, when people take the time to leave an Invest Talk podcast review on iTunes, we like to thank them for the courtesy by getting through the questions quickly. The Puma 51 says, I'm 28. I have $50,000 in my Roth 401k, and I was wondering if I could utilize money in my 401k to use as a down payment for a $285,000 home. Would I still pay a 10% penalty for using 401k money as a down payment before the age of 59? I'm trying to get the lowest monthly mortgage payment possible. So with the Roth 401k, I haven't really thought of it. I know with a Roth IRA, you can take out the contributions penalty free. I haven't seen that with a 401k. Let's see. I don't know the distribution rules. Let's see. Yeah, it looks like that's from a 401k. I don't know. Do you know this answer, Luke?
I actually don't offhand, because my first thought was like you for an IRA, but I mean, totally guessing here, logically. I would assume, again, you would have to check this, I would assume that the contributions you made could be withdrawn tax-free.
Just like a Roth IRA. If there was a
match from your employer, I imagine there'd be a penalty on that. And I imagine any of the gains you made would be penalized as well. But certainly you'd have to check that. But logically, that's what would make sense to me, given the rules for a Roth IRA. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah. Let's see. I don't know. I don't have the answer. This is probably something you find out online. We only deal with Roth IRAs, frankly. I believe a Roth 401k, you can't. That's what it looks like. I wish I had a better answer. I don't. Now, you can borrow against it like you can with a normal 401k. And there are rules for buying a house for a 401k and some exemptions there. But I'm not sure on a Roth 401k. I wish I was more help. It's just not something we tend to deal with on a regular basis. Thanks for the call, or thanks for the review. Let's grab another caller question now.
I was wondering what you think of Vanguard long-term corporate bond fund. I don't have the symbol, but it's Vanguard long-term corporate bond fund. It seems like a good time to be getting it. Thanks a lot. Love your show. Bye.
All right, looking at the Vanguard long. Well, I have to find the symbol.
Long, I believe it's VCLT.
VCLT?
VCLT, the Vanguard Long-Term Corporate Bond ETF, VCLT.
I'm assuming that's going to be the same as the mutual fund that he might be looking at. And it's pretty simple here. Long-term. I don't think anybody should be buying any bond fund that is long-term. This has a 13-year duration? No, absolutely not. I don't care how quality of the companies are, which it looks like to the credit quality. Yeah, it's moderate. Average qualities, A-. Yeah, it's all investment grade. So, you know, the credit risk is not the issue here. It's the duration risk. So I would absolutely not buy this. What are your thoughts, Luke?
Yeah, the weighted average life of these bonds is 22.8 years.
Yeah, it went from 113 before interest rates started going up all the way down to a low of around 67. Now it's up to 78, but this is not heading back to 100, that's for sure. So I would not be buying this at all. That's the call. Now we're heading into our final break. So get your questions in now at 888-99-CHART.
Every investor is working to build a secure financial future. How they get there and when they get there, that depends on many variables. The more you learn about how the market works, the better your chances. So don't forget to call InvestTalk, 888-99-CHART.
Hey, first-time caller here, Mike from Florida. I have a question about a stock, CWEN, it's Clearway Energy. Looking for some feedback on when you think a good buy-in point is for this stock. I'm thinking that the energy is going to be a good space with all the AI and mining going on out there, and just utilities are a good play in general. Also looking forward, I was thinking that with fusion coming into the picture and speculations is about 4 years, would you see this as a long-term hold or a short-term hold? Your feedback from that perspective would be much appreciated. Thank you. Bye.
All right, looking at Clearway Energy, CWEN, and this is a kind of like a fund. Right? It's a publicly traded energy infrastructure fund that focuses on investments in clean energy and sustainable and long-term contracted assets in North America. And this stock has been in a clear downtrend since late 2022 when it was around $40 per share. Now it's at 22 and change. And Luke, I think this is probably headed for bankruptcy in my mind. There's a ton of long-term debt. We're talking about $8 billion in long-term debt, $2.6 billion market cap. Its times interest earned is less than one. You know, this is a business that technically requires a lot more, a lot higher. It requires a low cost of capital to be profitable. And ever since, you know, interest rates have started to go up, really their free cash flow has fallen from $675 million all the way to $408 million. I think this would be a terrible place to invest.
I agree. I think that it requires a low cost of capital to be profitable, or it requires other types of revenue generating segments in order to break into, right? Like, renewable energy is expensive.
Yeah.
Creating renewable energy is very expensive. And over the past 5 years, their annualized growth rate is 5.7%. And so you extrapolate that forward and consider that, like you said, their times interest earned or interest rate coverage ratio is 0.8. I agree. I don't see how they don't go bankrupt.
Yeah, this is very far from, I like energy, but not clean energy, right? Because what things we just talked about. So you much better, you'll do much better probably in a traditional energy name, oil and gas. Thanks for the call. Let's talk a little bit about the trends in China. And the shall we call, love affair that Apple and Tesla had for a while in China. And they had a ton of their business, continue to have a ton of their business in China. And the latest quarter, China accounted for 19% of Apple's revenues and 22% of Tesla's revenues. But it's pretty clear that there's kind of a made in China trend that is happening within both of these spaces. Obviously, Huawei, and they launched a 5G phone as of late, despite the challenges that our sanctions have had on them. And then you have all of the Chinese electric car brands that are growing their production massively. And my question is this a coincidence? Tesla goes in and builds a factory there, and suddenly there's a boom in electric cars, car production in China. Do you think they stole their IP?
That's quite the accusation there, Justin.
Quite the accusation.
Of course they did.
I will say this. I know companies that have had their IP stolen by Chinese companies.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. That's one of the reasons why it's dangerous from a long-term perspective to do business in China. Yeah. And I think that another issue is the state is pushing buy local, specifically in phone technology. For whatever qualms people may have with Apple, Apple has been ahead of the pack in terms of user privacy. And why would a totalitarian government, you know, the government of China, want that to be the predominant cell phone that dominates their market?
Yeah, and the narrative is, hey, America's spying on you if you buy an Apple phone.
Let us spy similar, on you. Don't let America spy on you.
Yeah, very similar to what we talk about with Huawei and their ability to use the back door to potentially spy on, you know, Americans. So it's kind of a tit for tat type of accusation. But, you know, Tesla's market share has fallen from 7.9% last year to 6.6% of total Chinese new energy or EV sales. So, yeah, it's headed in the wrong direction, and that's why those tend to be the worst performing stocks of the Mag 7 this year. Now, that does it for another episode of Invest Talk. I'm Justin Klein with Luke Guerrero, and we thank you for we encourage you to tell your friends and family about our free podcast downloads, which you can find anytime at iTunes, Spotify, or Google Play. And be sure to rate and review on iTunes as well. And remember to check out our Market Madness contest over on InvestTalk.com. Independent thinking, shared success. This is Invest Talk. Good night.
InvestTalk is a trademark of KPP Financial. Because of the nature of the interactive dialogue inherent in the format of this program, it's important for the listener to understand that not all comments made will apply to them. Specifically, nothing said shall be taken to be investment advice, or shall statements on this program be considered an offer to buy or sell security. Because such advice is rendered solely on an individual basis and at times will require that the investor review a prospectus before investing. InvestTalk is a copyrighted program of Klein, Pavlis, and Peasley Financial, a registered investment advisor firm, which retains all rights. For more information regarding KPP's investment advisors, call 1-800-557-5461. Steve Peasley is president, and Justin Klein is chief executive officer of Klein, Pavlis, and Peasley Financial. Thank you for listening, and your comments and questions are welcome on our 24-hour listener line at 888-99-CHART.